Amen. I am going to embark on a series of messages, speaking truth to power, preaching a dangerous sermon. I was inspired by this series. Excuse me. When I went to Bethany College, the Orange Scott Lectures, Jim Donahue and I went a couple weeks ago, in case you probably not too many people knew. And there I met Frank A. Thomas, and the lecture was on for 2 days on how to preach a dangerous sermon. And I guess I'll say a little bit before I read. I'm not sure where I'm going to put the scripture in at, because I'm going to use 2 Samuel throughout this message. Eventually, I want to get to Paul, where he goes up onto Mars Hill. I really don't have no boundaries. I don't have any. There's a lot of room for discussion, a lot of room for group thought and sharing. I have outlines that I'm going to use, but basically, the script is wide open to whatever you want to say and add to it. And believe me, I'm going to probably say some things that it will prompt somebody to say something. That is the part of the dangerous message that Frank talks about. Now, I have to say, and I'm not really sure how I feel about this when I'm saying it, but Frank is an African-American. He's a progressive. Why do I feel unsure of myself? Why do I feel it's necessary to say that? I don't know. I'm not sure how I feel about that and why the necessity that I should say that. But it seems like for some reason, as we go, we live in a multicultural world. That's part of what we, how we characterize or we understand people's point of view. We have a lot of points of view coming from a lot of different people and a lot of different groups. And so I think that's part of how we understand where the ideas come from. The problem is I have with it is, would I say it was a white male? I probably wouldn't say that. And that's the part that I think is assumed in our society, which I don't know if is necessarily correct anymore. I think we should, if we're going to classify people by their ethnicity, then we should say a white person also. Because that's certainly, a lot of times by the time you get done describing the individual, you know pretty much the perspective on which they're going to be coming from, or possibly the perspective. Just think of all the candidates that are running for president. How much information you know just by what people say about them, this long list of pedigree that the person usually always refers to. So even though I am was uncomfortable a little bit or not really sure whether or not I should say that, but I did anyway. We have a tendency to pigeonhole people by their ethnicity, and this is some of the things that I want to move away from. I also want to, in this series of messages, look from a different perspective, seeing how most of us are white, and there's only a one person here, two people here that are of black. So I want to move to try to hopefully get us to look at a different perspective other than our own. And Frank helped me do that. Frank Thomas has helped me do that. It's not that I didn't appreciate other points of view. But empathy means to me is to share in the deepest way someone else's feelings, someone else's understanding, someone else's life or life experience. You can have sympathy, but that's not really, that's just basically saying, oh, but empathy goes a lot deeper, I think. So I think here is where I'm gonna inject the scripture. And it's rather long. I'm only going to read a portion of it. I think it's time to look at some of the history of Israel in the Middle East and look at it in a new light or in a different light. We have people that have different opinions about what should happen in Israel or in the Middle East. And I think maybe just looking back and trying to appreciate maybe someone else's point of view that is not necessarily attached to, or could be attached to, a nationalistic point of view. I think we're too tightly have tied our Christian faith to a particular political view. And whether or not that's right or wrong, that's something that we want to discuss or at least look at. So I'm hoping to move away by the term speaking to power, that I will eventually here explain that the phrase, but to look at it in a different light. That's my hope. And so I'm going to use the story of David and Bathsheba. But I have to give background. So this morning, we probably won't get very far, and that's okay. It's going to be ongoing. So if we back up on the history of Israel and the Israelites, eventually, Moses led them out of Egypt, and they came into the promised land. Joshua led the children of Israel into the promised land, and there they were to basically annihilate a lot of groups of people. Eventually, that didn't come out. They didn't do what they were supposed to do. Whether or not Yahweh, the God of Israel, ordered them to do so, but they didn't always do and carry out that edict. Now, if Joshua would have carried out what he was supposed to do, would we have the problems we have in the Middle East today? Well, the problem is that Ishmael had 12 sons, and they were peoples also. So I'm not going to sit here and say that the problems of Israel or the problems of the Middle East would have been solved if Joshua would have done what Yahweh, the God of Israel, told him to do. It's a little more complicated than that, I think. But as we journey down the history, eventually they became into the land, the promised land, and the land was divided out into 12 different tribes, and Joseph's two sons got their allotment split in half, and that's why they're considered to be 13 tribes rather than 12. And so eventually they were not supposed to have kings. They were only supposed to have judges. This is how it was supposed to be established. This is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, wanted. And so they were supposed to listen to the Spirit of God and to operate not as other nations, but to be separate and uniquely different. But they whined and carried on, and they wanted to have a king like everybody else. And so eventually it was Yahweh gave it into them, and Saul was their first king. And he didn't necessarily do what was right. He started out doing things, but then he went off on his own. He disobeyed some things and didn't do just some things. You can go read the history if you want to. And so Yahweh took his power and moved it to another family. The kingship was moved to another family. And that's where David comes in. David was chosen out of a different family. He was a shepherd. He was a lowly person from the backwoods. And he was one of many sons. And he was brought up and was anointed as king. And he was a man after Yahweh's own heart. In other words, he did what he was supposed to do in a lot of cases, but not always. Always the human factor in all these stories comes up over and over again. And eventually, there was animosity between Saul's family and David's family. Some complications became. Eventually, Saul fell on his sword in a battle, and he was gone. But there was still animosity in between. Jonathan was one of Saul's offspring, and Saul and David and Jonathan had a great relationship, but that's another story. So this brings us up to the time in which I want to start with David and Bathsheba. And there was, as in all history from the Middle East, there's been wars going on all the time. There seems off and on, it just seems that's the way it is no matter where you were. Even over on the Mongol side, over in what they call the steppes, listening to a series of history, the wars and just constantly on this earth between peoples have been around since the very beginning, it seems, I guess. And this is not unique in Saul's or in David's time. And so they were off having a battle, and Bathsheba was the wife of one of his generals, and the story goes that she was taking a cleansing bath, or I forget what the word is called. Does someone know? Because she a purification bath, and she was after her monthly menstrual period, and so she was considered to be clean. And David looked down upon her, and she was beautiful. And this Uriah was the general, and he had one wife, and she was very beautiful. But yet, with all the concubines that David had at his beck and call, he wanted one that he couldn't have. And so he saw her and lusted after her and sent down a messenger to tell her to come up to him. And there they made love and they conceived a child. Meanwhile, Uriah was out in the fields fighting. And so Uriah came in, there was a break in the fighting, and he came in, and David wanted him to go and have relations with his wife, because she was already pregnant. And so by him having relations with his wife, then he could blame her, or them two, for his offspring. But Uriah would not. Because he said, I'm going to stay with my army, my forces. I'm going to sleep where they sleep. And I'm not going to go home and spend time with my wife. And so twice King David tried to get Uriah to go home and spend time with his wife and have relations with his wife. But he wouldn't do it. So eventually, and this upset David. And so David took and put Uriah, told his other generals to put him out in the most forefront area where he knew he would get killed. And so therefore he could eliminate him. He could then have his wife and have Bathsheba for his for himself. And so there, in those days there was prophets. And these were people who spoke truth to power, basically. And I'll say a little more about the phrase truth to power, speaking truth to power here in a minute. But it wasn't used then back then. Anyway, they would speak truth to power. And so he was a prophet, and he was given the voice of God. Now, the voice of God, which eventually I'm going to get to down the line, hopefully I can... on Pentecost, talk about the journey of the voice of God and how it changed through time and what it means through Pentecost. But at this time, there was only a few people who were appointed by God who would have the voice of God speak to them, and they would go and they would have to do. They were chosen and God's elect to do so. Thus, God's elect is another thing that comes down the line a ways that is used in a way that it's not intended to use. But nevertheless, they were considered to be God's elect. And they were usually from the Levitical priesthood, and not everybody in the Levitical priesthood was considered a prophet. There was only a few chosen people, and there were some good ones and some bad ones. Anyway, Nathan was given the voice to go and to speak to David, and point his finger at, not necessarily point his finger at him, but speak truth to power. He was going to tell a story, and this is the story that Nathan tells David. And the Lord sent Nathan to David. When he came to him, he said, and this is the story, there were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb that he bought. And he raised it, and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food and drink from his cup, and even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to a rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep and cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him. Instead, he took the ewe of the lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. David burned with anger against this man and said to Nathan, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this must die. He must pay for the lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity." And Nathan says to David, "You are that man." This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, said, "I anointed you king over Israel. I have delivered you from the hand of Saul. I have gave you master's house to you. I gave your master's house to you and your master's wives into your arms. I have gave you all Israel and Judah. And if all of this had not been too little, I would have given you even more. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah, a Hittite, with the sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Amorites. Now, therefore, the sword will never depart from your house because you despised me and you took the wife of Uriah, a Hittite, to be your own." This is what the Lord said. Out of your own household, I am going to bring calamity upon you. Before your eyes, I will take your wives and give them to the one who is close to you, and he will sleep with your wives in broad daylight. You did it in secret, but I will do this in broad daylight before all of Israel. Then David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." And I'm going to stop there in the reading, and I'm going to paraphrase the rest of it. What happened to the child that was conceived? Nathan said that the child would die, and that's what happened. And eventually, he married Bathsheba, and they went on to have another child, and that was Solomon. But it's an interesting story. Now I'm going to back up a little bit. And this is the book that I'm going to probably be using some of along the way. And it is called How to Preach a Dangerous Sermon. How did I relate to this book, and how did I relate to Frank Thomas? It was one of the many workshops that I've been to out at Bethany College. But I think the more I think about it, the more I realize how much he has opened my eyes to a different way of looking at things and a different way of thinking. I used to go to these places and sit in the corner somewhere and not pay attention, and I was always fearful of engaging and not feeling equal to anybody that's there, because most of these people are professional preachers, professors and what have you that go to these, and I'm just a little truck driver that comes there to enjoy. But I tell you that, and I don't say this boastfully, I have come to the point where I can at least sit at the table. I might not be equal, but I will consider myself to sit at the table, and I enjoy sitting at the table, and I'm no longer afraid to share what I think. It may not be always correct, or may not always agree, but I'm not fearful no more, or not very much. And for me, that was a big step. I mean, I can remember years ago, just speaking in front of somebody in a small group, in a discussion group, wouldn't have happened. And so God has given me a lot of grace along the way. So what does it mean? I'll start off by explaining the title, Speaking Truth to Power and a Dangerous Message. And I'll take the dangerous message side of it first. What is a dangerous message? And I have to say right from the start, I think this church does a pretty good job at speaking kind of a dangerous message. We're not afraid to go out to the edge and to talk and to express ideas, even though they're far beyond traditional thought. And that's basically, in a couple words, that's what a dangerous message is. It doesn't speak. It would be very easy for me to stand up here and say things that everybody believed or thought, which or traditionally thought. Now, in this church, it's not always thought. I can't say that because that's just not necessarily true here because we have a variety of beliefs. But in traditional churches, it would be very easy for me to simply stay up here and speak things that are very comfortable and that everybody believes. God is love. Everybody loves you. You're saved and you're all gone to heaven. And say amen. And just reiterate that one Sunday after another. But as you know, I don't generally do that. I'm looking to go out to the outer edge. I think if my calling is to speak to the peripheral edges of where people are. I have that ability, if I may say so myself. I may not be perfect, and I'm not the best by no imagination. But my calling is to speaking to the peripheral edges. And I don't know if I should even call them peripheral edges. Because I think they're becoming the new norm. There's such a variety that's out there now that what is the norm? I don't know. And I don't think anybody knows. Yes?
But if you stop and remember anybody that's been through traditional church, you weren't allowed to have an open mind to explore.
No.
But yet, within the Bible, I think that it's a guide to truth.
Yes.
But you, as a human being, it's up to you to explore that truth and to find out for yourself.
Yes.
That's how you do that. That's like what we do in this church.
Yes, but
the more open you are about it, the more you understand it.
That's what makes us a dangerous church.
Correct.
And I don't say that flippantly. It's what it does. We are not. Yes.
I think I've always thought that these younger people that go right from the start to be a minister through college and that, a lot of them just kind of think, well, that'll be an easy job, I'll do that. And they don't necessarily leave as much as us ordinary people do when they just want a good paying job.
You would not believe the number of ministers that I run into that have just that attitude. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to be judgmental. I don't mean to assess something. After a while, it just becomes obvious. I just can't deny it no more. And you're exactly right.
What did he say?
He said that some people choose ministry as a profession because it's an easy way to make money. Believe me, I've run into people that... It's very easy. I mean, from my experience doing what I'm doing, it would be very easy to go to a traditional church and preach in a traditional church. You could have a whole series of messages, and that's what you just rotate through. My mother told me, or I heard, that when a minute, this is back then, I don't know about now, that when they were ordained, they were given a book full of messages. And basically, that's what they preached out of. And Revelations was something that was never supposed to be preached out of in Mennonite church. That was then. So the only way that you could change them is your style and your delivery. And to some extent, that's still done today. Yes, Jerry?
Well, see, the biggest difference between a conventional church and what we have here is a conventional church, the families, it becomes a routine.
Yes.
Okay. Where here is something that is enjoyable.
Yes.
Our gatherings. It's something that we do and we enjoy in. And that's the difference. It's not just sitting here listening to the man.
Eventually, I'm going to do a message on the voice or the mic. Who controls the voice and who controls the mic? Eventually, that's down the road here a little bit a ways. And you're right. You're speaking to that. Most pastors want to stand up here and tell you what to think and then go home and sit down. And it's not really relating to people in general. And I know I'm making an assessment. It's a generalization. I'm not putting every church in the same box. But I have to be very careful at doing this because I'll be putting myself in a dangerous spot, which it's okay. I speak up against it where I can anyway. So speaking a dangerous message is anything that goes against the norm or settled thought. There's a lot of what was considered to be settled thought, as a term that's used, or a belief system. So if you're a Methodist or you're a whatever denomination you are, you only have parameters in which you can speak. Yes, you can bump up against them, but believe me, if you go outside of that, you're going to be shown the door. And a lot of times when you come into various different churches, if you think differently, when you start expressing that, there's the door. You're not part of our group. Diversity is not a part of traditional churches. And I say that in a generalization. Now, the word tolerant has been in play here more because a lot of churches are tolerant of people who come there who are different. But tolerant is not the same as accepting. Tolerant just means that they can come in there and sit. That's it. They're not a part of the system. If you try to be, even a lot of male-oriented churches, there's a lot of male-oriented churches even today. Equality does not exist in the church across the board. You know that. We all know that. And so a dangerous message is anything that goes against that norm. But I also want to say one thing. That in a dangerous message does not necessarily put you in a dangerous place. I think a dangerous message delivered correctly offers hope. There's hope and the way I see that is, because you think differently does not mean that a traditional church will not necessarily offer you hope, but a dangerous message may offer you hope because you think differently. But
that you're not the only one.
That you're not the only one who thinks this way. And diversity is really something that should be embraced. A lot of different ideas. It offers hope. I think it offers more hope to people than trying to get them to believe something that they don't believe or they don't understand. I think there's a lot of that too. There's a lot of not understanding what you're speaking and what you're saying. They're taught this way, they believe this way, they express this way, but the depth of their understanding is not very thick or very deep. So a dangerous message speaks in depth. It's not necessarily just a right way. Do you think Jesus preached a dangerous message? Yeah. Jesus was dangerous across the board. That was his whole message. It was across the board. They killed him for it. That's the danger in preaching a dangerous message.
And he knew that. He
yes.
Knew that he was just kind of asking for it, but he didn't quit.
Right. Did it anyway. He had he had something to do. Frank believes, and which is as well as I do, that the church should reclaim its rightful place. We are not in the right place we should be, in general speaking. We should be engaged in the world around us with ideas that are happening in the world. We should be, if you could have been out there at our Sunday school class today, it was wonderful. There was a lot of sharing of a lot of different ideas. We only had a very short segment that we even dealt with. But there was so much said. There were so, as Colleen said, midrashing. There's many different viewpoints in which you can look at different things. And everybody takes away something different. And everybody is at a different spot. The church has to speak to that. And that's what Frank thinks. to be socially engaged. My question to him was, one of them, most of the times I shared what I was thinking, but I asked him, as towards the end of the lecture series, I said, do you think we're going to get there, and where is there? And everybody went, ooh. And so his there, believe it or not, he gave a pretty good answer, and I'll share that with you. His there was where there would be equality for all. Where people would have good health care, where people would have a good job, where everybody would have a flourishing life. And that we have, is a, we have a long way to go to there. Equality is very, and where is there? Oh, yes. And where is there and will we get there? And the way he saw it was that every generation, each one of us, is like a race. Where you hand a baton off, you carry it for a while, and you hand it to the next person, and you hand it to the next person. And so that's how he explained there, where, you know, will we get there, and where is there? There is really no there. We're just basically a part of getting humanity to another place. And I thought that was a fair assessment of what the question. Speaking truth to power. How many people know where that came from? Came from the Quakers. It was our friends next door. And it was maybe phrased in a different ways throughout history, but the term was coined by a Quaker, speaking truth to power, not against power. You don't speak truth against power, you speak truth to power. What Nathan did here, he spoke truth to power in a story. He said, look here. See yourself here. He didn't point his finger at him right away and say, you're a bad man. You did this and this and this. He left him find out for himself in the story. He spoke truth to power. It's a pacifist way of looking at and to being able to speak something to, or to make a comparison. You say, this is what you should learn, or this is how you should see. You get the individual to see. Speaking truth to power, none of them are physical in nature. Speaking, what is speaking? I'm speaking here. Do you see my words floating out across there? Between here and there, there's a lot of things can happen. Your mind is going to work a lot of different way. And it's a non-physical or spiritual in nature. Truth. What is truth? Anyone want to try to give me a definition of what truth is? No one's even going to try.
It's more than facts.
What?
It's more than just fact.
More than just fact. That's a good... Okay.
Truth is how you interpret something, too.
So truth is not concrete?
No.
Huh?
No.
Not? Well then, how can I measure truth? Isn't there truth in which there's no, like, giving? No give to it? No flexibility to it?
Well, that is, there is a lot of flexibility to it. There is a lot of flexibility to it.
A lot of flexibility to truth. Wow. That's heresy. I was, yes, Jay.
The thing is when you're out there speaking, using you, okay, it's what we're accepting from what you're saying is on how much that is actually what we accept as truth.
Are you saying I don't speak truth? I know you didn't say that, man. I couldn't help it. I'm sorry. What?
If you're an absolutist, there is a truth.
Okay.
An exact truth.
So,
a defined truth. A boxed in truth.
So I have to add another word to truth in order to make it concrete.
Say that again?
Huh? I have to add another word to it in order to make truth concrete. An absolutist, she says.
Somebody says something and they think they're lying, and They are.
So can somebody be totally convinced that they're totally right, but yet told an absolute lie?
Yes.
I think that's true. So we are already in dangerous zone by explaining truth the way we did.
Oh, you think that's true?
I think that's true, that we are in a dangerous zone, yes. Traditionally, we are in a dangerous zone.
Yes.
Absolutely. Do I agree with you? Yes. I was told this is God's word's absolute truth. The problem is, yes.
Backing up a little bit and let we go with that. Do you think those people, that the people picked to talk to God, you think they're really talking to God when they're picked by the people?
No, the prophets weren't necessarily picked by the people.
Oh, weren't they?
No. No. It was the voice of God picked them. That's how that worked.
Who said
it got picked? Well, there was a test that was done by prophets. That if you prophesied about something and it didn't happen, then you were a false prophet and they killed you. So you want to make awful sure that what you were speaking was true, or off goes your head, or whatever they did.
Or it had to come to pass.
You couldn't say a prophecy was usually given like in a very short term. You know, several years or whatever. Or you had to see it, and if it didn't come, a lot of times it was like very soon. So if it didn't happen, that's that.
If the person said it then, and they didn't have death come to them.
If what?
If they said it, but they didn't get killed, then the statement is true.
That was one of the tests that it was. So if you prophesied about something or you said something and it came true, and you can say, well, he was a lucky one, right? He just happened to guess it right. It was a lottery and he got the right one. Well, eventually he's going to get caught because you can only do it in so long and it's not going to happen.
Anyway.
Well, you want to die prophesying falsely? I don't know if I want to do that. See, it's a big responsibility. The prophets, the true prophets were really given a blessing and also a big responsibility. And that's why I say, when people are chosen and God's elect, you better make sure you're doing it, which is a theology that is operating today on a large scale. So you better make sure you're doing what God told you to do or, you know, whatever. I mean, I don't know what I want to be. I'll just stop there and let that one go. So, truth, as we say, is by association, by experience, by knowledge, by what Sharon said, if you travel around different places, you have a different view. Okay, so now we'll get to power. What's power? Is power a force? Is power an energy? Is it a potential? So if I'm going to speak truth to power, I have to have something that I visualize power as. Power, you want to say something?
Not yet.
Not yet, okay. Power is by definition, if you look it up, one of the things is potential. It's not necessarily an action. It's something that contains it. We'll say the government of the United States has power. But you have to act out on that power, and then it becomes a force. So power is the potential of something. It's not horsepower or torque. You might be sitting out there in your car, you might have a motor car that has 350 horses or 450 horses on it, and it's just sitting out there. It has potential power. But until you engage it, then it has horsepower and torque. So power is something that kings have. They have the potential to act or not to act. So God has power. So we act out in a way with power. And it says, one of the New Testament says that Jesus was going to give them power and authority. Yes.
Money has nothing to do with power.
Well, there's different kinds of power. So if you use money as an illustration, you can have a gazillion dollars in the bank. That's power. But when you start taking that money out and using it for various different ways, then you're turning that into a force. But the power still exists there in your money.
Or that dirty word, control.
Or that what?
Control.
Or control. Well, see, that now control is not necessarily power. All I want to do is describe power. The minute you move out from that, it gets a little more complicated. Power is just the potential. I like that word.
You're using the concept of potential
and kinetic, like you're using
energy.
Yes.
It's sitting there. It could do something.
Yes.
It has the ability to do something.
Yes.
If it's put in motion.
Yes. That's what power is.
Very well said.
Yes, she did. She did a very good job. This is what these messages are about. I'm hoping to engage. This is what it's all about. So all three of these things are non-physical things in reality. They're metaphysical in nature. So right away, speaking truth to power is something that is a non-reality, or it can be a reality in a way. So if I was going to move it over to a modern day explanation, which I have now suddenly, another one popped into my head. How would I speak truth to the current administration? I'm not expecting an answer.
Can't.
Huh?
That's a dead end.
That's where power comes into it for either good or bad, or you engage power in a way that, yes, I think, Carol, you're right. We have to say something. We have to do something.
Well, you get enough like-minded people to overrule the less.
Well, in this country, we have a democracy, majority win. So, yes. That's one way of speaking truth to power in this current administration. And I don't want to go roll it over into a political a hate or dislike or whatever. So I'm going to move it to another political, non-political idea. There's two things I want to bring up, and then I'm going to close. And then we'll move on next Sunday. The abortion issue. It is a hot button issue. How you feel about that is a variety of what is truth. The idea that it's totally wrong, no exceptions, I find difficult. So if you're going to say that is murder, then for me, I have to say war is murder. If you kill somebody, it's murder. Every taking of life is murder. And if you're going to make every life to live, then you have to have a safety net to hold that person up. You have to. It has to be part of the whole thing. These are just my opinions. I'm sharing them. I'm in a dangerous spot. I understand that.
Well, then not making health care available to everyone is kind of murder under that definition.
But the truth, as people see that issue, is not all the same. If you lean more on the conservative side, you're given life as you can choose whatever you want. On the more, I say moderate side, but you should have help along the way. I think that's a more, that should be more a moderate idea to a left idea. We need safety nets along the way. And what I am encouraged by the youth, I hear more and more that like the students at one of these schools out in Colorado, one of the political leaders went, and they didn't want to hear. They wanted to hear more about healthcare. The speaker wanted to turn it into a political issue, and they turned it into an issue on healthcare and turned around and walked out because mental health care is what they were talking about. Mental health care. So, yes.
I think it's all according to the way people think. When life is life and when it is just working up to life. Like if it's 1 month, 2 months, 6 months.
We'll pick up there next Sunday. And one more thing I'm going to throw out before I leave. And to stimulate your brains a little bit. The idea of how we view the Middle East. Whether or not you agree or not, there is about three or four women who are very vocal about sharing a different view of how they see the Middle East and Israel. We'll move down the line. Eventually, we'll get there. And my point is, not everybody... These groups who were on the other side of Joshua and all these wars are now giving voice to a different view of the Middle East. I'll leave you with that, and I'll pick this up next Sunday on how do you feel about the Middle East? Is that a viable way? Should we look at it differently? Should we separate our theology away from a nationalistic point of view? Can we do that? I'll say amen right there.
Crown, good Lord, show me the way.